Danger. The emergency disrupt system is now activated.
Welcome to the Lorehounds. We're your guides to xenomorphically induced terror. I'm your host, David, and this is our season wrap-up for season one of Alien Earth on FX. We ran squadron style this season so that we could divide up our coverage. We had Foundation going and Peacemaker. And I will, before we get into it, I really just want to give a quick shout out to all the members of the squadron. It was an excellent season of podcasting. I had a lot of fun. I hope you guys all did as well. So thank you to Luke and Alicia representing Woolshift Dust.
Mark
from Nevermind the Music and Ian from the Captain's Pod. Lore Masters and budding podcasters, Brian8063, Doof71, representing the fan community. They did a great job. I had a lot of fun with them. Steve and Anthony from Properly Howard Movie Review and our unholy experiment of trying to fit a Properly Howard vibe into a Lorehounds format. And then we had Ron and JD from Dungeons and Durags. That was a lot of fun talking with those guys, and I hope to be talking to them as a duo in the future. And then capping it all off was Aisha from Every Single Sci-Fi Film Ever podcast. And the real monsters are the friends that we made along the way. John, Foundation is over. What do you got going up next?
First of all, reviving the Silmarillion, which has been slacking for not having
dormant,
sleepy. Dormant, yeah. Marilyn and I are going to be doing our podcast. First one back is going to be a banger. I just want to say that Torin Turambar is our first subject.
Cool.
It is the darkest tale in all of Tolkien.
Mm.
And then we're considering doing, Alicia, we got to talk about this, but we're considering doing some of these fall shows.
Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, I think, you know, I told you that for one, a one shot would be a good idea. And I think for the other, we could do it like we did with, you know, Penguin or, you know, where we do a couple episodes at a time.
Yeah.
Oh, is this the Welcome to Derry?
Yeah, mm-hmm. it mm-hmm. show. And then the other one is the Telemasca show, which is in the Interview with the Vampire universe.
Okay. Very cool. Cool. Alicia, how is Peacemaker this season?
Whew, it is. I mean, if you're not watching Peacemaker, get on it. I'm trying to think, when did he write this? A couple of years ago, but good Lord, is it topical.
Relevant.
Mm. Uh-huh.
We've had a couple of shows like that, like Andor this season, mm-hmm. and certainly one battle after another is very, very prescient. Mm-hmm. It's wild, so.
I think you're going to be talking perhaps about one battle after another.
Yeah, there's multiple conversations going on, so I got to see what actually shakes out. But yeah, we're going to definitely be talking about it. It's still okay with me. I saw it like 2 days ago, and I'm still being affected by it.
So my thing about one battle after another is that I think that it uses fascism, the conversation about fascism, as a backdrop rather than exploring it.
Yeah,
right. Whereas Peacemaker is really drilling down hard.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to say too much. That's already a bit of a spoiler. But yeah, it's the last two episodes. So we now have 7 out of 8 episodes out. And episodes 6 and 7 have been... Yeah, really wild. They're getting above 9 scores on IMDb. People are going crazy for them. They're a lot of fun, but they're also like very emotional, very dark, but still with hope within. So it's been a really great season. Yeah. And the season finale, I mean, by the way, John Cena, he deserves an Emmy. Actually, so does Jennifer Holland. But the final episode next week is going to be an hour long. They've been mostly just over half an hour this season. And apparently it's going to be as important as anything else, quoting James Gunn, for the next Superman movie, Man of Tomorrow.
Wow, I didn't expect that from Peacemaker. I didn't expect you to drop that kind of spin on Peacemaker. It sounds intense. All right, well, we're here for Aliens, so let's shift gears. Spoiler warning for all things Alien ever. Quick reminder, we do have a season pass running, $10, flat fee, no ads, and a bunch of bonus content. Alicia, you and I just recorded a topic or an episode on the topic of Frankenstein and how it shows up in the show, because you've got a big Frankenstein project coming up. I'm going to be talking with Aisha about the Peter Pan principle next week. Mark is going to look at all the outro music, and he's got some thoughts and some things that he wants to say. And Nicole is interested in the show, and I've been encouraging her to check it out, and she's going to catch up on the season, and we're going to talk about what she comes up with from sort of a human psychology standpoint. So there's still a lot of content coming. Regular subscribers, you already get all this stuff, but if you're interested in supporting the podcast and you don't want to do a regular subscription thing and you just want a one-time purchase for $10, that's a ton of content. 8 episodes. We have 2 3-hour episodes in there because we broke the seal on that. The link is in the show notes, and yeah, good to go. We've got some blog posts up. If you have any feedback, avp@thelorehounds.com. That is going to stick. That email is going to stick around because we're going to use that for all of our Aliens and Predators content. And we have Badlands coming up later this year, which is going to be a movie. We'll do it definitely. Yay. I know, Alicia, you and I are probably going to do a one shot on that.
Definitely.
Yeah. And then, as always, we have our Discord server. And if you have anything nice to say, we would love to have your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. It makes a difference in terms of discoverability and such. All right. With that out of the way, let's kick off the episode. We got an email sent in by one of our long-term Loremaster subscribers and dear friend of the pod, Peter O.H. Peter emailed me very early on in the season, said, I'd be interested to see how the Lorehound community ranks all the universe's monsters by scariness. As in, if you had to be murdered by one, which creature terrifies you the most? Compared with some of those creatures, getting ripped open by a xenomorph is almost a peaceful death. And here's the primary list. And the way that I was thinking about doing this is like, let's not answer. We can talk about it a little bit, but let's not answer these. And then I'll put up a real poll. And on the straw poll platform that we use, and then we'll put it out for folks for kind of a fun thing to do. But the list is any version of a face hugger chest burster, including variants of the xenomorph, such as the Deacon or the Neomorph. John, I realize too that you may not be fully versed in all the alien lore. So
I do not recognize some of this stuff, the stuff from outside of Alien Earth or the original Alien.
Right. So what I'll do is I'll put some pictures together for the poll so you can see what the things are. I would have had the poll done earlier, but this requires some like graphic design and I just haven't had the time, right?
You do you.
Full-grown xenomorph, Deacon, or Neomorph. A Hammerpede from Prometheus. Death by black goo consumption. Death by eggification, as per the director's cut of Alien. Peter's really going deep. That's a deep, deep cut right there. Blood ticks. T. Ocellus, that's the eye midge. And D. Palumbicare, that's the, what did they call it in their show? The orchid, the big plant creature. And the flies.
I like to call it fauna. Sorry, flora may presents as flora, but maybe fauna. That's
exactly. What I call
it. It was skittering across the back wall at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, you in blinking, you'll miss it. But yeah, it's there. It's moving around in the room. So it's pretty cool. And then there's the flies. But the flies don't eat organic matter. So, you know, it's questionable.
They are gross.
Yes. I'm not. And Peter concludes, I'm not including anything from Alien Resurrection or the Predator stories. All right. And Peter loved the show and the podcast so far. So I will put these together with some graphical aids and then I'll post that around. But you guys can be thinking about it. Anything jump off the top of your head there? Even John, if you don't know the whole of the lore, do you have a preferred method of death?
Okay. This is best death, not worst.
Do I have a preferred method of death? I don't know. I don't want to say the face hugger, but like, I mean, you forget about it. Right. Like, and then you live a nice little life for like 30 minutes and then, you know.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And then you have like 2 minutes of terror as your chest is being torn apart.
But like then it's an almost insta death.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to pick the xenomorph.
Good. Good. Any initial thoughts, Alicia?
The nascent xenomorph, not the adult xenomorph.
Right. That, yeah.
just like getting dragged through. I mean, that last episode, I saw people complaining that the xenomorphs were not terrifying enough in this. I was like, no, getting dragged through the hallway by a xenomorph is terrifying. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Having one standing over you, breathing on you. Yeah.
Right.
Alicia, any initial thoughts? And you're welcome to change your votes once the poll goes up.
I'm going to, for similar reasons, I guess I'm going to go with my girl, Imidge. Okay. I think it would be over quickly. And then at least my body is being used. She's accessing my brain. So I'm not.
Or Alicia, do you know whether you are aware but not in control of your body if the Imidge is controlling you? Because I'm not certain of that.
I'm pretty sure that, because we've seen the Imidge crawl into dead bodies. I think the sheet falls over
when the Imidge leaves her.
So I think you're dead. Sure. As soon as Imidge comes in, you're dead.
I don't know. I'm not convinced. I have a theory of where they're going with the Imidge.
Okay. Excellent.
But I mean, then I would rather merge consciousnesses with the Imidge than cease to exist, I guess.
I don't know if the Imidge is going to let you merge consciousness. I think you're just going to be in the back seat for the rest of your existence.
It does keep you eating, right? It knows how to take care of your body. So,
right.
That. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think I'm leaning towards flora that presents as fauna, or fauna presents. Yeah. What's
really? That looks really painful.
Well, if it's quick. Mm-hmm. And a surprise. Like, I don't know that it's there. I'm just walking down the hall, scrubbing some mold or whatever. And it chomps me. Then that's it. I'm done. So,
yeah. I think I would say that the worst death would be the blood ticks, in my opinion. That looked extremely painful and scary. And
yeah.
I hate bugs like that. You know, I hate ticks.
Yeah.
John, what are some of your general thoughts on the season overall? We're going to get into more topical areas once we get on the other side of the break. But I'm curious, you speed ran the season. Thank you for catching up like that. You and I are both fans of Noah Hawley. We had a lot of fun covering a season of Fargo, such as it was. Well, we didn't cover it. It was, didn't we do?
We did two, we did like a midpoint at last.
Right.
So, yeah.
So what are your general broad thoughts?
I mean, I thought it was great. It could be that I saw some vague complaining. I didn't know what was happening, but I saw some like vague complaining about the second half of the season slowing down or not really knowing where it was going. And maybe that's what made me have lower expectations going in and then be pleasantly surprised. But I thought it was great to the end. I really did. Of course, it sets up a second season. And I think if this is the only season, it's a disappointing season. Mm-hmm. But if this is just the start to the story, I think it's a fantastic start to it. It surprised and delighted me how much it used the xenomorph as sort of a color on the palette rather than the focus.
Mm-hmm.
That was always my worry with a show like this is like, all right, well, how many different angles can you look at the same monster from? But it's not, it does look at the xenomorph from an angle, but it's looking at a different aspect of the world that at least I, having only seen the first movie, had never seen before. Is this, you know, obviously we've seen the corporofascism or the oligarchy, the tech oligarchy, or an alien, but we haven't seen an exploration of what is human. And I think that is the most interesting part of this show.
Right. Alicia?
This is definitely going to be in my top five. I'm pretty sure it's going to be in my top five of the year.
It's a tough year.
It's a tough year. It's a tough really year. Tough but year. This, for me, was an exceptional show. And of course, I am also a Noah Hawley fan, for me, particularly from Legion.
Right.
And this did everything that I hoped for from Noah Hawley in terms of the interest. There's a human element. And I apply the human element to the hybrids and the monsters, the aliens as well. There's a intense visual component, which is something that Noah Hawley really excels at. And it raises a lot of questions about society. It just gives me a lot to chew on in my brain. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And it entertains me while it's going and gets me into, we can see how active the chat was on the Discord about this.
Yeah.
This is obviously a lot of food for thought for a lot of people.
Sparking blog posts and Discord conversations. Yep.
Yeah. So as far as like the biggest biggest complaint I keep seeing is people are like, oh, people are acting so stupid in this show. I'm like, do you look at real life? Like, I don't understand this complaint. And I don't. And when we see these corporations in the show, I'm like, no, I do not think that they are hiring the best and the brightest, especially mm-hmm. for 65 year trips and whatever. Anyway, so I just don't have the complaints that other people do. Yeah, it does end in a way that kind of demands a season two. I think that FX would be extraordinarily stupid not to give it to us. I don't understand why, what the holdup is at this point. So yeah, I am high on this show overall. And by the way, you brought up the Frankenstein episode we did, and there was one more thing that I thought of after we recorded that I forgot to bring up that's an interesting parallel, which is, and this is one of the things I've been thinking about throughout the season, and I think a lot of people have, is Boy K saying that he just wants to have an intelligent conversation with someone. And of course, we've talked about, and I heard you and Aisha talked about, you know, the fact that, well, what does intelligent mean? Because he has intelligent people around him, but he just has his own hubris about what intelligence mm-hmm. means. That does tie back to Frankenstein and his monster also, because unlike the Universal movies that people think of, or where, you know, what is it? Dead, good, living. In the Universal movies, Frankenstein is not an articulate creature. In the books, he studies, it goes on, the book's timeline is much longer, so he actually does learn how to speak and becomes quite articulate. And we have several characters who have that same thing. We're like, I'm just looking for someone I can talk to. It ties back into the whole mad scientist thing that we were talking about. So it's about, if I felt any iota of sympathy for Boy K, you know, there's a loneliness in being intelligent. I just don't think he's as intelligent as he thinks he is. And I just find all of that very interesting.
It's just too bad the image was Abby Normal.
Mel Brooks. You haven't watched the Mel Brooks one recently, Alicia?
Not recently. I'm going to watch it this weekend.
All right. Oh. Well, the Abby Normal will. That's a joke from that one.
Stick out to you.
I think I'm in a place where I thought that there are some fair critiques of the season, and, you know, be there little stretching the plot and having to headcanon something here or there, you know, that's fair. Did the season finale stick to landing? We can debate that a little bit. Something that I am appreciating about Noah Hawley, and that really comes home to me in this season, is that he's a showrunner who is very heavy on vibes, and he can tell tightly plotted stories, but it almost felt like he was leaning more into trying to create something that was inducing feelings in us rather than a super tightly constructed Rubik's cube of a season. And, you know, I also know that sometimes a show takes a season or two to find itself and to tighten up. This was a expensive show to make. It is a high stakes property because it is in the Alien universe. And if you go on the Reddits or on the internets in general, there are still people who debate the ins and outs of 1979 and 1986 and, you know, all the other movies. It's an intense place of conversation and topic and ongoingly. And so to be able to take on a property like this and to get any measure of success out of it, that is a high stakes, high reward kind of situation. So I do definitely applaud him for that. And I think a lot of people aren't maybe used to Noah Hawley's show directions. I mean, Fargo is a big show, but it's not a massive show. And I think maybe a lot of people who are deep in the Alien world may have not. This is a theory, you know, or a supposition. Maybe they don't know Noah Hawley as a director very well. And so getting used to his techniques and what he does may be a different flavor of, I'm mixing all kinds of metaphors here, but, you know, a different flavor palette, right? Or he was painting with different sort of colors. So,
you know, David, as you're talking, I just want to raise a point. I would almost compare Hawley to Mike Flanagan in this, like, let's use the plot sparingly and you know, have an exploration of a theme.
Right.
Different points. However, I actually think I prefer Holly's method better because Mike Flanagan will use monologues extensively.
Yeah.
Do that.
Yeah.
And at times it's really good and beautiful and poetic. And at times it gets a little bit tell not show. And here, I don't think Holly ever really does the tell not show. He's very good at showing, not telling. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'll do sort of a Martin three-step reveal, where he'll have a character outright say something at the end. For example, the last line, I think it was the last line of the show with Wendy, with Marcy, whoever she is at this point. But he's leading you there before then, right?
Right.
And you can figure things out as you go.
I think that's a good observation, the one that I agree with. Of course, it's good because I agree with it. He's... The way that he tells story and the way that he works with the plot arc, the story arc, and then the character development, I think that's a good thing. I remember, God, what was the Flanagan one about the – I don't want to spoil anything, but it was on the like a Nantucket-like island.
Midnight Mass.
And there's a monologue in there where one of the main characters is talking. I'm trying to avoid spoilers. Talking about their opinions about death or something. And there's these long 5-minute stretches of dialogue. Very interesting, very well written. But yeah, like a lot of explanatory stuff as opposed to Holly, who boils it down and he gives you a little bit of character monologue. But it's not even monologue. It's just like a line or two of dialogue. Yeah. And you're like, whoa, it kind of punches you in the face.
Yeah, I just want to defend that quickly. That is, I think, my favorite Mike Flanagan show, but that particular scene you're talking about is my least favorite Mike Flanagan column. Because it is very self-indulgent.
And it felt very... I was really disappointed by the ending. That's talk about a show that, in my opinion, didn't stick the landing. It just felt like they ran out of budget. So they just kind of shortcutted a bunch of stuff. I
disagree with all of that. But okay. All right, let's move on. We're not talking about Mike Flanagan here.
All right. Well, regardless of all that, I am really interested to hear both of your takes. So we're going to get into in a minute. I wanted to run just a quick analytics to see where we are on the show. Normally, we apply these a lot to movies. But we can do some TV stuff for sure on here. Pukila scale for violence. I mean, this is top of the range, I would guess. The
limit does not exist.
Yeah. I mean, I can think of worse, but this is definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say The Boys is worse.
Mm-hmm.
But this is still bad.
Yeah. This is very high, exceptionally high.
Right. The Sanderson slider and the Shippey test, the Sanderson slider for adaptation and the Shippey test for source versus screen on-screen changes. There isn't source material here.
Well, I would still consider the original. Here's the thing. This is kind of blending with the Lopez test that you've said.
Agreed.
But the way that it fits with it. I would say, you know, having only seen the first Alien movie,
mm-hmm.
this feels like an inspiration more than an adaptation kind of thing, right? It's exploring much different things using the same color palette.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because people were complaining, which I don't get, that the opening scene was too much like Alien. people just looking for things to complain about.
And then if it wasn't too much like Alien, they would have complained that it wasn't Alien enough, right?
Mm-hmm. So. And people are doing that too. So whatever.
I think if you're getting it from both sides, you know you're in the middle. So
right.
To some degree. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think totally it passes the Lopez test for compatibility with Storyverse. I think he nestled it in quite nicely. Just like some of how we complain about Star Wars diversity in storytelling in terms of the eras and where they could be locating time frames for interesting stories and finding gaps where stuff isn't written. Or, you know, on
Justice
screen
for
already.
The Acolyte. Yes,
sir. We can place where Noah Hawley placed the show in the Alienverse timeline, I think, is a really interesting time frame. And I think it creates that connective tissue for hardcore fans because now we can go back and answer questions and see how things line up. Can he line up the tracks a little bit? And that gives a lot of energy for fans who are really interested in the world building and to answer some of those questions. So the Simsnard morality scale for main characters, this is your
area, Alicia. Basically, it's mostly about the intention of morality. And I don't know, like, who do we think is, who would be on the Juliet end of the scale here? Perhaps Arthur?
I think so, yeah. The only one.
Yeah, exactly. I would have defended Dame Sylvia at the start of the season. By the end, I'm like, well, she's her intentions are not immoral, but she is like so many people where she will do the wrong thing because it's the easiest or because it gets her what else she wants or because it doesn't disrupt her existence as an employee of this. And I still have, by the way, Noah Hawley, the finale did nothing to quell my my tinfoil hat theories, including the one that Dame Sylvia is a synth. So okay. I'm still saying all of that's on the table, which could explain some of her behavior. But for the most part, yeah. Boy K, obviously, worse than Simsnard.
Right.
This is from Silo, anyone who doesn't, Sims and Bernard are two characters in Silo. I can't think. I think Boy K, perhaps the worst in terms of moral intentions, but he's got a lot of company on that end of the scale.
Right. We have these three other tests, the Zatoichi scale for AI capability, the script notes, villain analysis framework, and the Priestley paradox for a perfect movie or show. These are still sort of under development, and I don't want to dig into them too deeply because I want to get into our main conversation. But anybody have any thoughts or opinions, or shall we just move along?
Do we think that the hybrids are AI? Do they count as AI?
That's a really interesting question, and I think it throws a wrinkle into the AI scale question, right? Whether you're bleep bloop, you know, lights and blinking lights, or do you have, Skynet capabilities? So,
Certainly they've all passed the Turing test, you know, even Kirsch
right.
and,
yeah. right.
And Adam.
So, okay, well, let's take a break. And then when we come back, we'll get into some more topics. We'll talk about the warm opens and the outro music. We'll talk about the story arc. We can talk about Noah Hawley a little bit more. I've got a really interesting voicemail that we can use as a framing device. We can talk about the characters and stuff. I have a question for you, Alicia. Maybe Dame Sylvia's the real Dr. Frankenstein here. We'll get into it when we come back from this
Frankenstein. Break. Is that why that joke didn't land with you, Alicia? Because that's from the Mel Brooks movie.
No, but it's Frankenstein.
No, it's yeah. The whole thing.
I get it.
Gene Wilder doesn't want to be associated with his grandfather,
right.
Dr. Frankenstein. And so he's like, it's Frankenstein the whole
right,
time.
Right, right.
Okay, all right. Anyway,
no, I get the joke.
Clear this error between us, Alicia.
I'm sorry, I don't laugh more at parodies.
Hey everyone, David here. We're almost done with Alien Earth, and I wanted to let you know about something that we've put together. We've created a season pass for our coverage. It's $10, one time, no recurring subscription. You can grab this whenever it works for you. What you get is ad-free access to all Alien Earth episodes, plus the bonus video analysis that I've already done, and several more background conversations and special episodes that I've got in planning. We put a lot of work into the episodes, and when it's all said and done, you're getting more than 10 podcasts for $10, which really is a pretty good value considering the amount of time and production work that we put into all the episodes. And look, we're an independent podcast, and having direct listener support like this means that we get to keep doing this kind of deep dive coverage that we all enjoy. It's pretty simple. So only if this works for you and your circumstances, no pressure at all. But if you've been enjoying Alien Earth coverage and want to support what we're doing while getting some extra content, the season pass is there for you. You can find the link in our show notes or head to lorehoundsnetwork.supercast.com. Thanks for listening and thanks for being part of this really great community. Sorry, what, John?
said, I love a dentist sound drilling into my head in the morning.
And Alicia, I cut you off there. Sorry about that.
Oh, I was just going to say, I gave Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein 2.5 stars.
Okay. What?
I'm sorry. I don't like parodies as much as you guys.
I mean, look, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I'd like that as much if my grandpa didn't show it to me when I was a kid, but he did. Mm-hmm. And so it's always going to be like.
I mean, I enjoyed it. I gave it 2.5 stars and a heart.
Heart?
Yeah, the Letterboxd.
What's the conversion rate?
Well, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you can rate by stars on how good you think something is. And then a heart is whether or not, for me, the heart means whether or not, like, do I want to rewatch this? And I'm like, yeah, I would totally rewatch this. I don't think it's good, but I would totally rewatch it.
Yeah. And this gets into the setup for the Priestley paradox of a perfect movie. You know, a movie can be perfect and you cannot love it, or you can love a movie. And yeah, I mean, you know, there's any combination thereof, which is just because it's flawed or perfect doesn't mean you can't love it for mm-hmm. what it is.
Right. Exactly. Nice. Yeah. And Lou Costello, I have not seen that much of him. I know that, you know, my dad's a fan of like the Three Stooges and stuff. And obviously Lou Costello is sort of the father, grandfather of that. He's amazing. He's very good at what he does. It's just not my type of humor.
Well, let's open up the conversation. We've got a really great voicemail from one of our active Discord users, Banamana. Banamana. they wrote out
Banamana.
The
phonetic Banamana. Banamana.
Exactly. That's where my headcanon's going in this. They sent in a written version of this, which is at the end of our outline if you guys want to read it. But they also sent in a voicemail, and I think the voicemail does a really nice job of framing context, sort of a larger context for our conversation. It's a little bit long of a voicemail, but I think it's interesting, so hang with it. Here we go.
Hello again, Lorehounds. Great season coverage. I love the show, and the season ending worked for me. The story isn't about Yutani versus Prodigy, so it's fine to me that they don't resolve that plotline yet. It's about who will you become, making a name for yourself, and what will you sacrifice to make that name. Boy K has made tremendous moral sacrifices to propel his name and company. Arthur and Sylvia have compromised their morals for scientific advancement, Sylvia to a higher degree. The children begin the season by having their names stripped from them and assigning them new ones, attempting to direct them into who Boy K wants them to become. Like when the Babylonians gave their Israelite captives new Babylonian names to assimilate them. Daniel becomes Belteshazzar. In Neverland, this works for a time, but one by one, the Lost Boys begin asserting their individuality. This transformation is spotlighted as they assign new names for themselves. Toodles was first to rebrand himself as Isaac, the scientist, fulfilling his statements from episode 1 when he declared that intent. When Nibs believes she is pregnant, she names the child Clarissa. That's what she wants to be called, she says. Is this her struggling to understand the concept that she herself actually needs to become someone else? And this is how the recent trauma is expressing that idea in her mind? Moro told Slightly, how can I trust you if you don't tell me your name? A name gives you power. It identifies you, represents you, it defends you. Then Moro abuses Arusha's name, threatening his family. So making a name for yourself is also dangerous. It exposes you. Wendy's case is complicated by her attachment to her brother. She struggles to identify with her brother as Marcy and with Neverland as Wendy. By the end of the season, she has not yet decided who she will become, and thus has not chosen her new name. She doesn't want to become a copy of Boy K, who killed his father and took his place. So she's instead imprisoning the whole lot who decided to tell her who to be while she decides what to do. Will she become him anyway? Because that is where she's headed, as she declares, "Now we rule." An appropriate season ending that makes us ponder her trajectory. Although I hope season 2 finds her reevaluating her course and the name she is making for herself. By the end of the season, Curly is beginning to shed her Neverland name. Will she also come to view her human name, Jane, as obsolete, as Wendy Marcy came to view her human name? They seem to be realizing that the people they used to be are dead, and they must become something new. Even the xenomorph is subverting expectations of who we think it is. Using language, communication, and cooperation, will it rise above our preconceptions of its predatory nature? Can it make a new name for itself? As I contemplate this season, I reflect on Kirsch's words in episode 1. You are born, you live, you die. All we can do is watch and take names. This is what I'll be doing in future seasons. Watching and taking names. Discord name, Phenomena.
Bup, 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 bup.
I was waiting for somebody to do it.
Phenomena, thank you so much. This is a kind of feedback that I absolutely love to get. And I want to encourage everybody, you don't have to be as polished with this. And we've got some more feedback that will filter through the outline. But this is lovely. This is like a mini blog post. And I really appreciate you taking the time to record it. It's very well put together. But as you guys can see, it's a really great framing. I mean, we can see this, all kinds of points that Phenomena brings up throughout the overall conversation. But I'm curious, Alicia, do you have any initial thoughts that spark off the voicemail?
I mean, of course, as soon as we talk about the power of names and how it... how it exposes you. I think of stories like, well, of course, we've covered Earthsea, or you guys have covered Earthsea. Mm-hmm. I've been a fan since a child as well. Stories like Rumpelstiltskin, obviously, that it's playing off of, and just this, there is a history of the power of names of someone, or even Cats, the musical. I have not seen the movie. I'm going to ignore it, but it is also about the cats having their secret name that humans don't know.
And speaking of Earthsea, Marilyn brings it up like every other time we record. So it's time we do the last episode.
Yes. Not the last. Come on. You have more.
I think we're doing one more.
No.
On the other win. on the last book.
Yeah.
On all the short stories together?
No. I don't think we're going to do the rest of the short stories. I think we're just going to do it. Well, we'll talk. We'll talk.
Okay. Anyway,
the original plan for all the short stories was to check in with various Lorehound's co-hosts and have them read a short, pick a short story to read and then have like a rotating conversation. That's a grand idea, and it's a lot of production work.
I volunteer as tribute.
But all right, I'll tell you what. Let's do the last book first, and then
and then worry about that. All right,
once we actually get something moving again, then I'll think about what we're doing with the short stories.
It would be a great ongoing little fun project as interstitial content. So that's for sure. John, did you have any thoughts that spark off this?
I think this is great. The power of a name is super important. And I, too, am worried about the direction of Wendy Marcy, the thing, whatever she is now. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, now we rule. I don't think that this character intends, at least, to be as cruel as Boy K.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very possible that she will be anyway. I also am very
Frankenstein's monster.
It opens up that question too of benevolent rule, like power is power, and she has human consciousness but a mechanical body. And would she be susceptible in the same ways as we are? Are there inherent conditions being in a mortal body? God, this is making me really think about Tolkien too, with serial longevity, if that's the right technical term for the elves, where if you don't have the pressure of death, how does that change your perspective and your outlook, and then ultimately affects the use of power, how you use power?
It also reminds me, and I don't remember if Marilyn brought this up on any of your podcasts with you, but there's this thing in Discworld where after death, has severed the soul from the body,
mm-hmm.
Death's talking to the person and they go, "Why don't I feel angry anymore?" He goes, "It's all in the glands."
Mm-hmm. It's true.
So these robots don't have glands, right? But at the same time, they clearly were built to simulate emotion, mm-hmm. to feel like they have emotions. And that's clearly different from Kirsch, who is just, you know, kind of dead eyed and, you know, just straight up just purpose driven.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how this will work.
And I think about some current circumstances that are happening globally, and where we don't cover concurrent politics directly in our podcasts, but we can, you know, reference them sort of obliquely at times. And whether it's current or even in the history, in human history, I would say that a lot of the leaders who are the most destructive, both in terms of human lives, human resources, you know, and it be those monetary resources or other, you know, real, you know, cities and towns and things like this, that the most destructive people who have led great armies and things like that are dealing with their mortality, that they're reaching for something that is to immortalize themselves. And a lot of our stories, especially our fantasy stories, involve people, I'm a, you know, a great hero and a name that will be sung for, you know, generations after my death. There's a sensibility there. And that's what I think Boy K is also dealing with, right? In terms of, you know, can we defeat mortality? Can I be mortal, immortal?
No, you're too late. Sorry, boy.
We're all too late.
Yeah. So he brought up also about Jane, Jane's name. And I find that a really interesting case because, you know, so Jane was Curly's name in the before she died, before she was transferred to a hybrid body. And she's been struggling with who is she? And she wants to be special. She wants to be special to Boy K. She doesn't want Wendy to be the special one. And then Wendy tells her, actually, your name fits into this whole story framework in an interesting way that Boy K has set up, because Jane is actually the name of Wendy's daughter in the book. And Jane is the one who, you know, once Wendy turns her back on Boy K, Jane is the one who, on Peter Pan. Jane is the one Peter Pan then takes next to sort of replace Wendy in a way. So Jane then at that moment chooses to re-embrace her original name. But is that her connecting with her prior identity, or is that her connecting with this new identity that Wendy's explanation has made possible for her?
Mm-hmm.
Peter Pan underutilized as a horror character. And I think, honestly, like, the original Peter Pan is horrific. And I think that this show is a good stepping point into, like, hey, why are we not questioning this a little bit more?
Yeah, when you have people rummaging around in your thoughts at night, cleaning things up so that you get fresh and new.
This immortal being is collecting children on an island.
And it's where Aisha and I are going to talk about this on the upcoming bonus segment, about this idea of the Peter Pan principle, that so much of modern Western American driven culture is based on a Peter Pan principle, on this sort of lost boys thing, forever young and never having to grow up and face responsibility.
You're letting a Brit determine American culture? Better than this, David. Dew's gotten to your head.
I mean, the Native Americans would like to tell you that the British have determined all American culture pretty much so.
Oh, the French were involved for a bit too. And, you know,
and never mind the Dutch, who are the single largest monetary investor in the United States economy as it stands. So,
well, we got a lot of stuff named Stuyvesant in New York City.
That's right.
Is that a Dutch word? The whole
thing? Yeah, it's a name. It was the name of the original, what do you call the governor? The Dutch governor of New York, or it was New Amsterdam then.
And or like Arthur Kill and all of that. Kill, I believe, is the word for river in Dutch, or a body of water.
No, yeah. It means chill.
Well, all around Staten Island, all of the water things are the waterways, like Arthur Kill.
Oh, it's probably a person's name, yeah.
Mm. So I'm sure somebody can write in and let us know. But anyway, yes, the Dutch, there's so
Brooklyn,
much about here.
And yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. The one thing that I really thought of when Bananama was talking about who will you become was that very first Andor trailer where Forrest Whitaker as Saul Guerrera, you know, we hear a voiceover, who will you become? And it just gave me chills and really made me fall in love with that movie even before it was out. And this idea that under pressure and under duress and existential, you know, these really questions of your existence and how are you going to get through this difficult situation? What does that do to you? What does that do to a human person? And then what does it do to a consciousness that's been transplanted? So, well, let's switch topics here a little bit. I want to talk about the warm opens and the outro music and see what your opinions are of sort of these bookends of every episode. But Amy M., one of our Patreon supporters, thank you, Amy M., for your support. We really appreciate it. Wrote in to say, hey, I just wanted to support your co-host in the last episode. That was Aisha. Last episode's opinion of the music. I didn't like it either. So no, she's definitely not the only one. Thanks for all the coverage, Amy.
There's been a few who have popped up on Discord saying mm-hmm. that.
Like, see, well, Aisha, you're not alone. There are dozens of you.
To each their own.
John, as the new person to the Alien franchise, you don't really have a history necessarily of films and other things to compare with. So just on a straight television line, what did the outro music do for you? Was it fun or was it distracting?
I'm trying to remember what it was. I don't think it did anything for me.
Well, no, it was all the rock songs at the end.
Oh, no, I think that's fine.
Boy, that's a
no strong feelings.
It was fine. Like, I barely remembered it. You know what I mean? Like, I can't have much of an opinion on it with that.
Wow.
Yeah, which is funny because I'm getting back into music again, but
yeah,
that's what didn't really strike me.
Well, I'm excited to talk to Mark. He's going to look at all the songs from all 8 episodes, and he said he's got some ideas that he's going to cook up for kind of analyzing. He's getting very lore houndy about it. I Alicia, did you like the outro music?
Stagnations? Yeah. I mean, I love the outro music. I think going hard with the music is perfect for this show. My favorite needle drop, though, was, I've brought it up on the Discord, it was, I'm a huge Alt-J fan, or I used to be a huge Alt-J fan, and now I'm like, well, I should be listening to their stuff again. Right. But yeah, they dropped Tessellate in one of the episodes.
That was a really great one too. With the airship flying between the cities, it was just a very baller.
It's such a good song. It's such a good song. And if you get a chance to see them in concert, they are great in concert.
I picked up two new artists, Alt-J, which I'd never heard before, and what was the other one? Radio Killed the TV, or no? What was that? I'll have to look it up. But it was the episode 1 or 2 where Windy jumps off the cliff and
Radio Killed the Radio Star. Is that what you're?
Is that who they're called?
That's a song, right? That's a song.
Are you talking about TV on the Radio?
TV on the Radio. That's okay, it. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had never heard of them before, and I absolutely adore that song that they used.
So. I'm going to mail you a vinyl record because I have a vinyl record of them, and I do not like it.
Okay.
I want you to enjoy it. Okay.
I will find a record player in a thrift store and relive my Gen X. I told this story yesterday on my game night to my guys because so a couple of the guys that I play Draw Steel with are musicians and they're mixing down their record right now and a new album. And so we were talking about albums. And I tried to show my daughter and her niece at Christmas one year. We were staying at this rental house where there was a record player, but the record player didn't have a needle and the armature was broken. Uh-huh. And so I was like, girls, check this out. And they were like, and it didn't work. And they were like, bye.
No, my kids love the record player that I have. My son figured out which button starts it. And he's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna press this so much.
I had when I was a small kid, I had a little, my parents have always had a record player. They still do. They have a great vinyl collection. But they gave me a little kid record player and I would have like, Berenstain, not Stain. They changed it.
right.
But I would have like these stories or like Disney stories or stuff that, and that was one of the ways I helped teach myself how to read. You know, I would listen to it and read along in these matching books, but it was just like a little so that my parents didn't have to worry about me breaking anything.
I had a Steve Martin comedy record that, oh man, I listened to over and over again. So good. Okay, now I'm going to have get a record because I have a really great amplifier up in our attic. I've been thinking about setting up my stereo in my office.
Player, you know?
And dear listener, even though this is an Alien Earth podcast, this was just a little taste of what we talk about on Second Breakfast, the exclusive podcast for subscribers. This is sort of the things that we do when we, just the three of us, when we have a show to cover.
Especially this this week where we got very unhinged.
We did.
I think at least I should both not sleep before every Second Breakfast.
It just interacts with the ADHD in a nice way.
Do the things we do for content, dear listener.
Speaking of ADHD, can I just say I love that whole section with Kearse going, with your ADHD, with your severe ADHD, you know, your medication, the breaking up about it. And I thought that was fantastic.
Yes.
You're prone to impulse control issues.
I thought it was interesting. So we can just sort of start sliding, and I think, into talking about story and character writ large. So we don't have to have any defined boundaries here. But I thought it was really interesting that that Noah Hawley wrote in so explicitly a diagnosis, like referencing that. I don't think I've ever heard many other shows or movies sort of explicitly do that. And say you
had an explicit OCD diagnosis for Mother's Milk.
Say again?
Mother's Milk and the Boys has an explicit diagnosis. There are some exceptions, but I think you're right. Generally, people shy away from it.
Yeah.
And also another example I'm thinking about for OCD was in what was that movie we covered? A Real Pain.
Mm-hmm.
Diagnosis and was like, I take a pill every day for it. And
right.
Dying for Sex is a great one for ADHD. Jenny Slate's character is, she talks about having ADHD, and there's so many recognizable things about it. Like I brought up the purse in another podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Jenny Slate. I'll always think of her going, money, please. In Parks and Rec.
So Cincinnati Joe, one of our subscribers and good friend of the pod and very active Discord user, wrote in on the show overall, in the end, he liked it and wanted more, but it wasn't great. It wasn't as great as I'd hoped it would be given the cool setup in the early episodes. They left so much unresolved. For example, I thought we'd get some insight into Kearse's background or motives. We didn't even know who created him or why Boyke seemingly trusts him so much. We've got some more Boyke. I'm really losing it. Cincinnati Joe coverage or feedback in when we talk about some characters, and he has some thoughts on Dame Sylvia. But as a story, you both enjoyed it. Did it work as coherent television? And did episode 8 stick the landing?
I mean, for me, if it doesn't, I want it to continue. If it doesn't continue, I'm fine with where it stopped. But I do think that Hawley was setting up a lot of things that he said. Yeah, I mean, when he first talked to them, it was originally supposed to be from the jump, a 2-season show. And I think I've heard 3 seasons now floated or something like that. But yeah, this was not designed to end here. And if it does end here, I am absolutely going to blame FX and not Noah Hawley. I still have all my theories about Kearse, and I still believe them all. I think that this last episode confirmed them for me.
Be you, Alicia. Be you.
We will get season 2 and I shall be proven right.
I was trying to think. And look, I think it was about 3 weeks from the end of Shogun till when FX gave the official announcement about a season 2. But that's a very different circumstance because FX had a very original book that it was modeling off of. And so there wasn't necessarily a plan for season 2, but it felt like they kind of convinced the showrunners.
Once they run it all by Brendan Carr, everything will be fine.
Okay. Do you think, John, if you had known that season 2 was greenlit prior, would that have changed your opinions about the end of season 1?
Yeah, I think it would have improved it. Like, I will say, like, it's kind of like I think it was season three of Breaking Bad, where you're like, if the show ended here, it would be a really interesting, like, noir ending of just open-ended,
right?
You know, dark ending. And I think the same is true here. Like, you could end it here and it tells an interesting story, but it's a much better story if you can continue from here, because I don't think that we have fully
agreed.
We have fully explored all the hybrid characters. They are just awakening.
I think that's a really interesting point, that our expectations set our feeling. If we had known this is a one and done season, and with Wendy saying, you know, now we rule, right? And you get to that killer Pearl Jam song. Was it Pearl Jam on the last one? I'm trying to remember now. Animal, it was.
Let me run this by you. They don't do a season two.
Mm-hmm.
But then they go, all right, we're going to start making alien movies further in the timeline now, past Sigourney Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
But then in one of those movies, Wendy Marcy shows up.
Nice.
Yeah. That would be cool. Yeah, I mean,
she's immortal, right? Like, she could go anywhere in the timeline after this.
Mm-hmm. Assuming she survives. Yeah, you could play with it ad infinitum.
Right.
I mean, I would love that. My first choice would be continue, because I'm not only in many ways, there are other characters in this show I'm interested in even more than Wendy Marcy. So I want to see. At the moment, I am just left baffled by FX not choosing to. It would have been, if they had announced the season two renewal before the finale, it would have been. Yeah.
I lost internet points because that was my prediction, was that FX was holding their green light announcement to a strategic moment. As we are coming near the end of the season, they would have popped up, you know, at 7 or 8 or something like that. Hey, we've greenlit season two. And that would have generated some more heat and brought in even more audiences, because that would have been a big headline. You know, hey, season two has been announced and we're not even done with season one yet. Bang, the show is a success. And that heat and momentum would have carried into episode 8. And then we would have felt like, oh, sweet, we're going to get a season two. This is a badass ending. Great cliffhanger, right? So to me, I think it's a strategic blunder that they didn't already announce it.
No, David, absolutely. You're not thinking about the shareholder here. You got to make sure that all the shareholder before you announce a season two, you know, you got to make sure that this is old news and all
the business.
Oh, the whole Kimmel aspect.
I'm just,
part of me wondered at first because we know, for example, because of the whole brouhaha around the Kimmel situation, they delayed, this is all Disney. They delayed, the Mandalorian trailer a few days. And then still when it dropped a few days later, people were still like, you're not going to distract us from that other thing. And then that was kind of the moment where they're like, no, we're done. We've resolved the other thing. And so I thought maybe this was being delayed for the same reason. But now at this point, I don't understand what's going on.
Well, they also, I don't know how coordinated the Disney timing is, because they also raised prices like during the Kimmel thing.
Yeah.
And you're like, guys, bad form here.
That was really dumb. I didn't know that they did that. It didn't happen.
Maybe it was like the day after they put him back on air, but like, yeah, they lost like a ton of subscribers, I think.
Yeah. There was news about the subscriber count. It was like over 1 million or something.
Yeah. So. And their stock was done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Their stock was down and it was like a bad moment for them. And they're like, let's raise prices. This is the moment.
Yeah. But this is also, so they have, there's been reporting recently that numbers have gone down throughout this show, but I think that this does play a not small role in it. This whole, that people were, because we know, for example, that there are people who are still watching the show, but they weren't watching it on Disney Plus.
Right. Right, right, right.
They were watching it on Hulu, just to be clear, everyone.
Sure. I'm just saying people.
So what's both of your opinions on the question of, did the season suffer from compression? We see this a lot in a lot of shows where it feels like there's an artificial cap on episodes, or the story, the showrunner and writers didn't really get all the room that they needed to tell the story that they started out to or intended to story. Tell the story of. Holly was in an interview saying he's used to 10 Mm-hmm. And this is an 8-episode season. So did the show suffer from compression?
I don't think it felt compressed. Okay. I think it didn't feel rushed and it didn't feel slow either, but it did feel like a perfectly paced first season of what mm-hmm. was intended to be at least a 2-season arc. Mm-hmm. It feels like they spent a lot of time implanting us into this part of the timeline and these characters and setting up all the interesting things. And you feel like there was meant to be a season 2 to realize all that.
Right. John, compression?
No, I thought it ended at the right time. Mm-hmm. I did not think it needed more episodes. I didn't say how I watched the show, but I that I binged most of it.
Yeah.
But I waited until last night to watch the finale, and I'm going to pretend that I did that on purpose. But I actually think it was nice because I got to like mull over it for a few
mm-hmm.
days
mm-hmm.
and then have fresh takes on the finale. And I felt like I was like, all right, good. We're wrapping this up. It's good. It's the time to do it.
What is your take on episode 8?
I thought it was great. I thought, which was the episode where Kirsch kind of psyched out the Yutani people? That was my favorite episode.
When they had the meeting, where him and Moro, like,
I think it was episode 6.
Oh, you mean the crawling on the table episode?
The feet.
Hey, look at my feet. when he goes, where? What do you think you're doing? The beach is that way. You know, it's that part. That was my favorite.
Oh, that was episode 6, I believe. The fly?
I think
or it's 7.
Fruition in 7.
Emergence.
I think it's like 2 episodes. But basically, yeah. I loved that. Kirsch, I think, is my favorite character because I love how I can't read his intentions.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, and maybe I'm jumping ahead to your discussion of characters. But
no, we're formless now. We can drift and wander.
But I really love how you think that he's working for Yutani for a minute, right? You're mm-hmm. like, oh man, I think he's actually a double agent. And then he just uses the boys as bait.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, as long as I know what they're doing, I can I think, but also there's another secondary possible motive of like, hey, why don't we see if the on a scientific standpoint, why don't we see if the xenomorph is different if it comes out of an alive human instead of a lung?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's all these different motives you can ascribe to Kirsch that are not human emotions, right? Mm-hmm. These are cold, callous, machine-driven emotions.
Mm.
And if our robot overlords in 10 years hear this, know that this is not derogatory towards you. This is not a technical AI.
I really do love the Kirsch character, and I'm glad that Timothy Oliphant was the only other really wide known. I mean, I know that Alec Lawther is a very accomplished and storied actor, but really in terms of an American, bigger American audience and maybe global audience, his career is not as well known. So Timothy Oliphant is like this one big star. And I kind of like the fact that they kept the scope of the actor profiles narrowed like that so that Timothy Oliphant, his portrayal of Kirsch, it just lent something extra in a way. And I just loved all the little quips. You're grounded. Or look with your eyes, not your hands. You know, all these parental things that he did, he just sounds exactly like so many parents that I know mm-hmm. who are not shouting at their kids, but they're like, do not touch that.
Also, I love him in interviews. He's just so charming as a person. And that can't help, even though he's playing this android who doesn't have feelings.
Yeah, very
or whatever.
Spock-like, right?
Vulcan-like. Yeah. Well, although I think that, you know, this is a question throughout Alien, obviously, is do the androids have emotions? And some of them, I mean, I think all of them seem to, actually. I think that people tend to underestimate them. But anyway, his charm can't help but seep through.
Well, Bishop says that in the 1986 movie when he's going out to the Comlink Tower through the little tunnel thing, and Hudson says to him, like, yeah, you go, man. And Bishop says, look, I'm an android, but I'm not stupid. So they do have a sense of self-preservation
And yeah, but I think that we see them having emotional attachments to, and it's like sure. people, it differs per, you know, like we mm-hmm. see in Covenant, we see a big difference between David and what's the other one? Anyway, the two doppelgangers, mm-hmm. they are the same, ostensibly different variants of the same model, but to see their lived experiences take them in such different directions, emotionally and intellectually.
Right. So I teased a question earlier, Alicia, about Dame Sylvia. Cincinnati Joe wrote in your episode 8 coverage, I thought that you were a bit harsh on Dame Sylvia. I think Aisha said she foolishly went to the grave because she feels above things. I think they were portraying her as distraught and probably grieving. She feels they're not handling the hybrids well, and generally things seem out of control with Isaac's death and Nibs's issues. She may be misguided, but she and Arthur did seem to care for the kids who were dying of cancer and got a new chance at life. Also, I'm guessing that she knows her husband is dead, even though they haven't explicitly shown that. That would help explain her foolish decision to visit the grave. Why go there unless she's thinking about death? Probably it was she and Arthur who were responsible for their being graves. So my question to you, Alicia, is Sylvia the real Dr. Frankenstein?
Well, just to respond to what he said here, mm-hmm. I completely agree that I think Dame Sylvia has done wrong things. But I do think, as I was saying when we were talking about the Simsnard scale, I do think that her intentions have been good. She's mm-hmm. just at the end, at the last moment, her husband chose morality over preservation and she chose preservation over morality. Mm-hmm. But about the question about what do you mean? Why do you think that would make her the real Dr. Frankenstein?
Because and please correct me if I have a misassumption about Dr. Frankenstein. But Dr. Frankenstein, as you mentioned in our bonus episode, got hyper focused on the project, mm-hmm. and then at some point was like, oh my God, what have I done? Like I'm so taken with this idea and I'm just so wrapped up on it. And then I didn't think about the consequences. And I wonder, you know, did Dame Sylvia in her interest in care, as Joe says, for the children and mm-hmm. giving these children a sort of sense of hope. But at the same time, she's very committed to the transhuman project and seeing this project through. And she's willing to stay with Boy K after Boy K fires her husband, who is sort of the head of the IT side of the project. And she's like, yeah, mm-hmm. I can do it. Okay. You know, bye, Arthur. You know, she doesn't walk out in solidarity with him. She makes a choice to continue the project for whatever her own motivations are. So the whole Dr. Frankenstein thing is like, I'm so in this that I'm not thinking of the consequences.
Yeah. I mean, I think just the fact that she shows any care toward the children disqualifies her, because that is one of the definitive things about, and this is not true in like the 1931 movie and derivations mm-hmm. thereof, but in the original book, as soon as Dr. Frankenstein animates the creature, he's like, I'm horrified. What have I done? I reject you, creature, and you shall go out into the world to suffer. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, the fact that she wants to stay close to them, she wants to keep taking care of her, sort of makes her an anti-Frankenstein in a way.
Interesting.
But yeah, she's definitely, it was funny, Aisha, it's come up a few times in her podcast and conversation with her about this idea of the female mad scientist and why we see that less. Dame Sylvia could, she's not there yet, but she could go that direction.
Nice. John, did you have any thoughts about Arthur and Sylvia and their moral conundrum?
Yeah, I mean, obviously Arthur is the empathy hero of this series, right?
Who's punished for doing a good thing.
right. But at the same time, well, I wonder, is Arthur going to have like some kind of role in his, like, we've never seen the image attached to a human. Well, but no, we did actually.
But this is what you were hinting at earlier about, does the human, is there something left of the human after the image takes over?
Right. I think that we are being hard on Sylvia, but maybe not untoward to Sylvia.
Mm-hmm.
I think she kind of has earned some of her some of the flack. I mean, she erased the memories of, mm-hmm. of Nibs, and you know, I'm thinking of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Like, some people would choose to erase the memories that traumatize them, right?
Mm. That was a really good podcast when we covered that.
That was. You know, yeah. I can't help but pick the best movies.
But Millennials.
Nibs was not given agency, right? Nibs, mm-hmm. Nibs was not given the opportunity to decide, do I want to erase that traumatic memory or not? And I think that's what makes Sylvia a bit villainous here.
Right.
I do think she was grieving and reflecting on her own mistakes when she visited the graves. I don't think she's a sociopath.
Mm-hmm. Like
Boy K might be. But
100%.
I think that she is a complicated character, right? Like she did some villainous things. At the same time, she's a human being, and she feels remorse for some of those things. And her husband leaving, I think, was the big catalyst for her to confront those feelings,
mm-hmm.
whereas she had been drowning them in something when you know, the whole season.
I think the point that Cincinnati Joan makes about the fact that it was probably her and Arthur who were responsible for there being graves, because I think Boy K would have been like, oh, well, it's, you know, toss it out with the trash, right? They're right. Not needed anymore, so off they go. I really do think that Cincinnati Joe's correct there. And that makes for a compelling and interesting villain, right? We could talk about the depth of her villainy, but that she is a complex character making really making choices that we can see in different lights, depending on you know, what outcomes we look at or what relationships that we see her engage in. And I think that makes for interesting and compelling storytelling. And it's the same with Moro, right? As Jean might say, you know, Moro can go kick rocks. But he is so compelling. He is so interesting
mm-hmm.
as a villain. I think he's, and Babu Cisse's performance is extraordinary. Oh,
yeah. And he's so different. You know, when you see him in interviews, that is not his personality at all.
Right.
He's very bubbly.
Yeah. And this whole thing brings me back to Hannah Arendt's The Banality of Evil, right? Is that evil acts are not generally done by supervillains and people who are without human emotion. They are done by regular people.
Mm-hmm.
They are, mm-hmm. It is the machine that keeps you going in these evil acts. And it's your ambition. It's your willful blindness towards acts that are morally challenging for you, right?
Right.
And so Sylvia, I think, keeps going, the greater good, the greater good, the greater good. We're going to make everybody immortal, even if we have to possibly kill these kids.
I don't think she would stand for, well, except for Nibs. I mean, I think she could justify shutting Nibs down at this point. But other than that, I can't see her standing for the kids being killed.
Right.
The hybrids.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I really don't know. I think she might be like, I think she might be at the point of, hey, we created monsters. We've got to shut them down. And I think she might be resigned to, especially visiting the graves. We did kill the kids. It was a mistake. We just have to get rid of the ghosts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. But it's not like she's tearing her hair out or, you know, fleeing the island.
Well, no, but I think that there is a part of her, it's preservation, as I said, but it's also a part of her that does, like, if she doesn't want to abandon the kids, mm-hmm. the hybrids.
Mm-hmm. She is pouring some healthy glasses of whiskey.
Yeah, I think she's tearing her hair out.
I want to talk about Moro a little bit more, though. We started to, and I just want to go back. I remember the scene where he attaches the computer electrodes to his forehead or to his temples, and we get those pulsing lights, and he's sweating. And it's just the way that Holly continually visually and thematically put Moro alongside the xenomorph. as this, you know, creature, like when he stabs the guy on the ship on in episode 5 and he holds him up from the back like a xenomorph would with its tail. I just love the way that he's monstrous, but we can see into his past and we can have empathy for him at one level, which is interesting because he's also taking, Holly is taking the xenomorph and giving them language, which then creates a more complex and three-dimensional picture of the xenomorph. If they have cooperation, if there's some sort of rudimentary society involved.
Yeah, they got me on Moro with just one montage of his daughter writing letters. So that was it. Mm-hmm. And now, yeah, after that, it's really, and also, of course, the actor in interviews himself and his relationship with, this is another thing I really need season 2 for. I think that his relationship with Slightly and Smee in particular could evolve in a very interesting way.
That was some of my most favorite storytelling that was going on, was that that weird, yeah, I want to just preference this. I like the storytelling. I didn't like what Rose representing, the grooming aspect of it. Mm-hmm. But from a sort of a villain manipulating the stakes of the story, man, that was some expert level storytelling. John, what was your opinion of Moro overall?
Yeah, I mean, he's Captain Hook, right? I mean, he's, I think it's interesting because I don't know if this is true. I've been told, because I haven't read it, but the original Peter Pan, the pirates were the discarded lost boys, right? They were the ones who grew up.
And I don't know if I can answer that.
Is that true? Am I wrong? But did I miss?
Wait, repeat that. Repeat that. Sorry.
That the pirates in Peter, in the original Peter Pan story.
Oh, were previous lost boys? Oh, that does. Or I think there's at least a version of that where that was true. Was that so in Hook, the movie?
I don't think so. But anyway, all right. So let's go on that premise. I could be completely wrong. Marilyn, write in. Let's say that's true. That's exactly what Moro is, right? He is a former tool of one of these corporations.
Mm-hmm. Current tool.
Right. But I mean, he was attached to his own Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. And now he's aged out, right? Everyone he knew is now dead. Mm. He has nothing left. And so all he has left is to be a pirate and go in and steal back the treasures.
Interesting.
And so I thought he was a really good Captain Hook. I also saw somebody online saying they think Kirsch is the real Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. He's the one. He's the immortal one who is keeping these lost boys alive and keeping them and using them too.
Well, this is the fun thing that Holly's done is he's, because it's not a one-for-one comparison, that there are elements that are sprinkled around into different characters that it makes for endless fascination, right? The crystal, you can examine so many different facets of it.
Yeah. Two things on that. One, I just looked it up and apparently it's a fan theory that's
okay.
But it totally makes sense to me. But okay, my other fan theory in a way is, you know, we keep calling Moro Hook, and obviously there's obvious reasons why we do that. But part of me, and I know we have a character called Smee, and we're all questioning why is Smee one of the lost boys?
Right, because Smee was a pirate in the books, right?
Smee is like the second, yeah, the right hand of Captain Hook, so to speak. I didn't mean that to be a pun, but there
right,
it is.
Right, right.
but so then part of me wonders if, you know, there's also, if Moro is also the Smee to Yutani's Hook, because Yutani is the main antagonist of our Peter Pan. Someone on Discord said maybe Yutani's Tiger Lily, but I don't know. To me, she's a secret Captain Hook, and it makes more sense that Moro is her Smee, who's this kind of more morally ambiguous character.
Mm-hmm. Rufio. That's who I want to know.
Rufio. Yeah.
That's a Hook reference there.
Yeah.
That was only in Hook.
he's too busy ruling Fire Nation.
Oh, right.
Sorry, same actor played. Anyway.
No, yeah. I know.
No, for those who
every
don't.
Every time we put on Hook, Maya goes, look, it's Zuko.
Yeah. there's a great podcast about the last Airbender with him, Donnie Bosco, and the woman who played Katara. Oh, no, not Katara. Sorry. Frick, what's the second in the spinoff? The other.
Yeah. Yes, Cora.
Cora, thank you.
I should know that. My wife had a dog.
I should know that. I'm definitely, this lack of proper sleep is catching up on my brain juice.
What other characters or actor portrayals do we want to talk about? Did Alex Lawther do a good job with Joe Hermit? His performance is the one that constantly flummoxed me throughout the season.
Can I tell you my theory on the name Hermit?
Sure.
Are you aware of garden hermits?
I don't think so.
Okay, this was a fashionable trend for the aristocracy in Europe from like the 15th century to the 18th century.
Okay.
And this was that you would allow a hermit, a person who
like had a real person,
a real person to set up a hut on your property in your garden, and they were ornamental. They would just live there. And you could go bring them food, you could go, you know, watch them. You just got to observe it's your hermit. You do what you want with it.
Can I apply for that job?
I know, right? I was like, this actually sounds pretty good.
It's like a watchtower for forest firefighters, you know, that sit up there in their isolated towers watching out over all. I mean, different job, but
I actually looked up pocket jobs. I actually looked up lighthouse attendants when I was like, let's think outside the box on jobs.
But so I almost think that
there's a whole Wikipedia article on
hermits. I know. Yeah. And so I think that Joe is being kept there as sort of the
yeah, that's interesting.
Garden hermit for Wendy, for Marcy.
I love it.
That's kind of my running theory.
That's your take.
What do you think the deal is with their dad, with Mr. Papa Hermit? We keep getting these hints that, you know, he went through something where he was sick or injured, or it's kind of vague. And this is definitely another season two question that's left hanging. And then it's, you know, there's sort of parallels with Wendy where I guess Joe couldn't visit him at the end either. So could he pop up as, was he an experiment for an older hybrid or,
My headcanon was that it's just a source of guilt and hurt feelings between the siblings. That, you know, he couldn't be there for Wendy towards the end, so further isolating her and making her more vulnerable to being used by Prodigy. And then Joe, you know, being away serving out his servitude in some unnamed corporate war on the other side of the planet. And so I think it's just a source of tragedy for that's my headcanon. It's a source of tragedy for the siblings.
I mean, if there's only one season, then I'll accept that. Or if there's a second season, watching out for Papa Hermit to pop up somewhere.
It may be one too many twists if they do something like crazy with him.
Right. Right.
But if they do it well, then I'll accept it. You know, that's kind of the thing with anything.
Maybe it was something where Holly was laying a little track just in case, you know, if the story goes to multiple seasons, that could be an interesting thing to explore in season three.
Yeah, I do hope that even if the show gets canceled, Holly like does what Mike Flanagan did with the Midnight Club and just like tweets out the
right. Yeah. Yeah, that, I appreciate Mike Flanagan for that so much.
Right, right.
Favorite Lost Boys?
Smee, obviously. Smee,
right? Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, Smee's pretty good.
Yeah. Poor one out for Toothless. Toodles, I'm sorry. I keep calling him Toothless. All season long, I was calling him
Isaac,
Toothless. I don't know why.
His name is Isaac.
That's right. Stop dead naming Isaac.
Poor one out for Isaac. I thought Lily Newmark's portrayal of Nibs was so good. If you go back, like I was doing freeze frame and, you know, really doing deep analysis and pausing the playback and stuff, her facial expressions, her reactions to things. There's a point when they're on the Maginot, I think it was maybe episode two, and Kirsch is saying something to them about like, oh, shush now, because Boy K was calling him on the comms and he was trying to hear. And Nibs's character sort of does this teenager eye roll, like, oh, come on, dad, like, you know, don't treat me like this. Just such subtlety in her performance. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of them.
31.
Yeah. Every single one of them, I can't believe they're not teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Right. They do such a good job of acting like children.
And this is where I really applaud FX for taking the time and spending the money and bringing in a, I forget what they said on the official podcast, but they brought in somebody like a child psychologist or somebody who works with children to help them sort of deconstruct their adult personalities and reconstruct a childhood perspective. And
yeah.
There's a great scene, I think, of slightly like walking down the hall and he's running his finger on the wall, you know, because he's just, you know, it's like you sticking your window out the car window, your hand out that car window or something like that. You're just experiencing the world and enjoying these random sensations. And that kind of little touch just really put their performances over the line.
Curly and is 36. Now I'm looking at all the ages. Yeah. I'm like, what?
But yeah, also just finding the right actors and they saved money on not booking a bunch of big names for this.
Sure.
They did that very judiciously. And instead they just found the perfect people to play these parts who could do that.
I really agree with that. I think that's Curly very is 26. Smart.
I'm sorry.
26?
Yeah, who is 26.
Curly. I don't want Curly, it's actress, Arana James, to be Arana listening James, to this yeah. and being like, why are you aging this? I know the show's cast is big fans of this podcast.
And what a great opportunity for all these young actors too, right? Mm-hmm. To be on such a wide release show.
Well, some of them are in their 30s. How old are Slightly and Smee?
While he looks that up, yeah. I want to also shout out Adrian Edmondson for playing Adam Ines. And if props to Luke, Alicia, for not only raising his hand first for, you know, even before I had the plan for the season, he messaged me on Discord. He's like, hey. I hear you're doing Alien Earth. Can I get on that? I was like, yeah, okay, all right, sure. And he helped actually create my idea for the squadron style and the setup for it all. So thank you. But if we hadn't had a Brit, a British person, point out that Adrian Edmondson is this very famous comedic actor of British origin, the depth of my appreciation for his portrayal would have been, you know, I would not have been able to appreciate it in the same way.
Yeah.
And I did get the ages for you, Alicia. Smee's actor is 29 and Slightly's is 31.
Okay.
Which is, again, like, especially Slightly looked so young. Like, I can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, I love watching this whole cast in interviews because they are all so different. They're also different from their characters.
Right. They're actual grown-ups.
Well, let's start
I really like at the end when Wendy says, I'm not Wendy, I'm not Marcy, I'm not a kid, I'm not a grown-up. And it really shows lost she is, right?
Yeah. No longer a girl, not yet a woman.
Is that and wasn't that, sorry. Wasn't that Wendy's sort of thing in the book? She was in that transition zone. Yeah. She was neither here nor there. Well, let's start to wrap it up. Is there anything left on the table, Alicia, that you have that you want to share or final thoughts?
No, I just want shows like this. Like, I know you're a big fan of The Pitt. I was bummed about it winning the Emmy because I want Severance. I just want shows like this that are inventive and that present storytelling in new formats and push that forward, how we think about storytelling. I want them to do well and get more recognition. So I'll be ranking this high on my list this year. And I really hope that we get more seasons. And I hope that this conservative swing that we're going through globally, that's also affecting Hollywood so much, I hope it doesn't clamp down on creative storytelling like this.
Gotcha. Yeah, for me, The Bear is also up there in that same thing where it's a show that's really challenging the form and saying, what can TV be? You know, if we start to mix in movie sensibility, cinematic sensibilities in our quality of writing, the delivery of performance, the way that we film things, the things that we can film because our technology profile is very different. So what does it look like when we start to erode the 1 hour or 30 minute format? What can we do?
I'm sorry, David, but I can't. When you go ask what TV is, I can't help but think of 30 Rock, where Jack Donaghy says, "We know what art is. It's paintings of horses."
I mean, that's not art.
My wife and I recently rewatched. And I think I mentioned this on Second Breakfast that we watched a little bit of season one, and there's that great scene where he's got a picture of the Trivection oven in his office on the wall. Brilliant.
Oh, it's so good.
Wrap up thoughts, John.
I just hope that there's a season two. I think absolutely fantastic show. Alicia said in her top five. I think probably in mine too. I just have to flesh out my list here.
It's a packed list this year.
It is a packed list. Although the second half of the year is less busy, which is interesting. Or at least the last quarter of the year is a lot less busy as far as we know right now. But
who knows? Welcome to Derry could blow us all away.
That's true. It could. So could the Talamasca.
So could. I'm sorry. I don't mean to I'm like anything that AMC does, if it's not Rolling Jones, I'm skeptical.
Look, it's a coin flip because Interview with the Vampire, fantastic.
Best thing on TV.
Mayfair Witches, one of the maybe the worst show I've ever seen.
Like I'm not going that far, but it definitely does not live up to.
I'm gonna go that far.
Well, and I'm here to quietly remind everyone that Vince Gilligan's new show, Pluribus, is starting in early November as well. And that is a complete unknown. Nobody has any eyes on that yet. So we don't know what's coming there.
All right.
My final thought, which I don't know what I'm going to do with yet. This show makes me appreciate Noah Hawley even more. I don't think this was a failure. I think there were some stumbles and some shortcomings, but none of it was so flawed that it diminished my appreciation. And one of the things that I love that Hawley does is he plays with these ideas of absurdism and cosmic horror. And in some ways, this is a very noir, neo-noir type of story where you start to realize that the world is bigger and more terrifying than you might have realized. So I just appreciate all of that mixing of bigger philosophical feelings. And he played with a lot of philosophy in this show too, as well as giving us action. So for me, this is damn near it's like you were saying before, Alicia, you can give it whatever star rating you want, but then this definitely gets a little heart rating for me because even with its flaws, I loved this show so much.
What flaws? No, okay.
So, all right. Well, I think that about wraps it up. I really appreciate you both spending some time coming in at the end. This was fun. This is a fun podcast. John, I'm really glad that you were able to speed run the season. So
thank you for asking me to do this. It's been a lot of fun. We don't get to pod enough together about media lately, David.
No, I know you and I have mostly not been on. Yeah, exactly.
And even Alicia, since the spring, we haven't really been on much. So
well. You have to catch up on Peacemaker this week, and then
so much more.
It's also only 8 episodes, but also
I am only on episode 3 of season 1.
Oh, right. Well, they're shorter episodes at least, but it's going to tie into Superman next week.
Oh God. All right. I'm going to say. All right.
Okay.
No promises here.
Awesome. All right, let's thank our supporters, our Discord server boosters, and our lore masters. Alicia, would you do the server boosters if you have it open?
Sure. Thank you to Aaron K., Tiller the Thriller, Doove71, Athena Ajalea, Listu, Nancy M., Ghost of Partition, Radioactive Richard, and Adrian.
And John, if you could thank the lore masters.
The Lore Masters, Samartian, Michael G, Michelle E, Brian P, SC, Peter OH, Adam S, Nancy M, Doove71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Matthew M, Sarah M, Andre B, Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Sub Zero, Aaron K, Dally V, Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W, Listu, Jeffrey B, Elisa U, Neil F, Ben B, Scott F, Stephen N, Julia F, Kali S, Ilmariel, /Tim, Paul K, Bobby C, Rocky Zim, Jessica H, Red Zippy, the TCS, Mick C, and Adrian. Thanks, everyone, for all your support. helps us get these wrap-ups out, huh? Maybe it'll inspire me to binge Peacemaker.
Binge Peacemaker.
And they
everyone tell John to binge Peacemaker.
There you go. Yeah, at him. Everybody at him on Discord. And the subscribers, you know, you guys actually prop up this, the you're the tent poles of this community. Anyone who subscribes, it gives us space to actually create this space. And so that's an important benefit too. You're not just, you know, directing support to us, the creators of the podcast, but you're creating the room and the place where we can all come together and nerd out on the shows and movies and stuff that we love. So final thanks to my season co-hosts, to you, obviously, Alicia and Luke for episodes 1 and 2, Mark and Ian, Doof 71 and Brian 8063, Anthony and Steve, Ron and JD, and our dear, dear friend, Aisha. You guys really made a great season out of television to cover with me. So I appreciate all of you and your spending time with us. Alicia, thanks. John, good to chat with you. And we'll be up for Spooktober is coming, right? Looks like Weapons is going to take it.
So. Yeah. So everyone start with Barbarian and Companion if you're a subscriber, and Weapons will come toward the end of the month.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.